Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and one that he stated was the previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I gotta tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we gotta do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment.
That is right, Stephanie, a safe environment. We want you in a safe environment, and that is why we are an AppSats partner-sensitive, trained organization, both coaches and clinicians, that will do our best to keep you safe. And, you know, it's interesting because I am interviewing Dan Drake and Janice Cavill, and they wrote this book, Full Disclosure, How to Share the Truth After Sexual Betrayal. And they knew that these workbooks would help the betrayer and the partner to do this in a safe way, hopefully facilitated by an AppSats-trained counselor. What we know is that you deserve to be safe. And as a result, you really should go to APSATS.org and find a trained specialist, somebody who's partner trauma trained. You know, we know that you have been through so much and you are experiencing, in most cases, a trauma stress response. That's at best. At worst, you may have post-traumatic stress or complex post-traumatic stress. But I want to assure you that at AppSats, this organization knows exactly what they're doing. And part of our first phase of keeping you safe is getting you to the right people, helping him or her, depending on who the betrayer is, to develop some good recovery. And then, in actuality, it's allowing a full disclosure to occur. Now, we recommend it, but what we know to be true is that the partner may not want it. And if they don't want it, that's fine. But we recommend it because we feel like you deserve that. And you need to know that. And if you don't have it, you may have many, many questions racing around in your head, ruminating. And that exacerbates the stress response. And so, again, it's really important that we keep you safe. And to do that, there is a whole procedure, that you can do with a trained specialist to encourage and increase that safety factor. And, you know, you're probably listening to the show right now because you want more information about what is happening to you and possibly
what is happening to the addict. I mean, there is no doubt that problematic sexual behavior can become very compulsive. And when it does, there's that inability to stop. The addict or the betrayer will put you in situations that he never intentionally meant to do, but he continues to do to perpetuate the addiction. And so we really want to help you and him to figure out what you all as a family system can do to get healthy. We know it's not just about you. It's not just about him. It's about your children or your grandchildren. It's about your community, your church. And so that's why when you work with somebody who is trained in this field, you're going to get their wisdom. You know, I had a woman who ran into another sex addict at a grocery store. And my client said, oh my gosh, Carol. She just started spilling the beans about how she had found out her husband had had multiple affairs and had done just despicable things. Went to massage parlors, sought out prostitutes, went to Ashley Madison, you know, websites that are absolutely set up for sex play. And she was just telling me this in the middle of the grocery store. And she said, I felt so guilty because I wanted to say, I know, my husband did the same thing. And I wanted to have a kindred spirit with her to let her know she wasn't alone. And then I wanted to tell her about you. And I wanted to tell her about my support groups. And I looked at her and I said, please tell me you did not do that. And she said, I didn't. And I said, you know, I admire the fact that you want to be supportive and caring and compassionate. But if this woman is spilling her entire story in the middle of a grocery store, she is so triggered that she is not going to be a safe person to share your story with. And there may be a time and a place to do that. You know, I've had many a partner who's made the decision to help somebody out by saying, well, you know, I've heard about these support groups and they're supposed to be very helpful. Or I heard about this woman who does sex addiction in Indianapolis and she's supposed to be really good. Or I heard about a partner trauma specialist that works with women that have gone through this. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to give her help, but at the same time, not if it puts you in more liability. And that's what we're really trying to keep you from. We don't want you to have any more pain. We just want to help you deal with this pain and then grieve the pain so that you can restore your sense of self, possibly the coupleship, and your sense of the world. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. When this kind of thing happens, many women question, why are they on earth? Why are they experiencing this? Why is God doing this? Why is the universe against them? And so it is our goal at APSATS to help you figure out the answers to those tough questions and to create a world that feels more safe, where you can begin to live your life, never in the old way again, because you've been through this, but in an improved way so that you can find your joy, find your purpose, and find your passion again. Very, very important. You know, oftentimes I help the addict to create coping skills to help you feel safe. And I get them formulas to do that. And you know, you've heard me talk about AVR.
the empathy formula, where they acknowledge your pain and your situation, and then they very clearly validate your feelings and then remind you how they are different, how they're improved, the work that they're doing, so that you can see you're not working with the addict who's in active addiction. You're working with somebody who's really working on recovery skills. And so I also talk about, you know, an addict who is working on good recovery so oftentimes wants to believe that because they feel so much different, you should feel so much different. And let's face it, you know that this is a process. This is a journey. This doesn't just happen, nor should it. We want you to be safe. And so I teach them the 7 principles of conflict after betrayal, because what I know to be true is that this now has added an element of conflict to everything. And so I'm going to tell you about the 7 things that I tell your husbands or wives, whoever the betrayer is. I ask them, when you experience conflict, ask yourself, how has my past contributed to the present day conflict? And then recognize that the other 90% is about your past and not who you are today. So I want the addict to realize that they have absolutely contributed and caused the conflict today, but I want them also to recognize that it's really about their past and not who they are, so that they need to continue to stay strong and do the next right thing to weather the storm of conflict. And then I ask the addict, I want you to hold on to accountability for causing the pain without going into the shame mode, without thinking that you're never going to get out of this, without thinking that your wife is always going to be angry. And then 3 is to know that although her pain is in direct response to your past actions, it really isn't in response to who you are today. It's in response to her fear that she still is not sure she knows who you are. And I think all you partners know what I mean. You want to believe all the changes and the progress. But at the same time, you're afraid to get duped again. And so you test the waters, and you may say some sarcastic or angry things because you're mad that you can't just immediately trust the addict. And then I want you to recognize that the addict has to know he's strong enough to be a container for your feelings. So I tell the addict, I want you to imagine that you are holding her feelings right there. You're holding her pain. You're holding her trauma. And that you will continue to hold it while you work on your own strong recovery. So that's what I tell your husbands. And I want you to know that too, that I'm going to be teaching them in this book how to hold your pain and trauma while working on their recovery and reminding you that they're working on their recovery to give you some hope. Because let's face it, your entire world has been rocked. And so as a result, you don't feel safe and you don't know what to do. And again, that first step into safety is his recovery. He needs to work a strong recovery program. I say for at least 90 days. We'll have to ask Janice and Dan what they think is the daily minimum requirement. I mean, they may say 3 weeks or they may say 3 years. I don't know. Well, I actually do know because I've read the book. But in addition to that, we'll ask Dan and Janice about the disclosure and some of the pitfalls or some of the ways that you have to navigate that so that you keep yourself safe as you're hearing the truth. So I am going to bring them on And I'm going to ask each one of them to introduce themselves. So Janice and Dan, welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio. How are you today?
Hi, Carol.
Hi, Carol. It's so good to see you or talk to you on the radio. It's so nice to have to be on.
Well, thank you so much. And you two have really made it your mission to help partners with this process of disclosure. And you also are doing that for what you call the betrayer, the person with compulsive sexual problematic behavior. So I'm going to ask each one of you, I'll start with Dan. Dan, what made you decide to write this book?
Oh, that's a huge question, Carol. Should be an easy one to answer. But I'll say first and foremost, I'm so honored to be a part of APSATS and being part of the board of APSATS. And so to be on this show is really, really an honor. So thanks for having us on. I guess the short story to a question is we started, Janice and I and another colleague, Dorit Reichenthal, who's also on the board of APSATS, we all had been working on another project, and we had a chapter that we were working on disclosure. And we were coming together and saying, hey, what resources do we have on disclosure? And we thought, oh, we put some resources together that we already had. And we thought, oh, this may be something that could be really helpful to the community. So we thought, oh, we'll just kind of put them together and create a little workbook out of this. Well, how long ago was that, Janice? Maybe 3 years ago? Let's say it was two. 2 years ago, and I don't know, it was a long time ago. And anyway, what turned into a little project became a mammoth undertaking, and we ultimately came up with a comprehensive approach for clients to help walk through the process with the help of an APSATS or a facilitated guide who can help facilitate this. So it was we just realized how comprehensive this complicated this process was, and we made as much of a comprehensive guide as we could do to really boil down such a difficult process and such a one that can be really painful and problematic and traumatic at times into something that we hope can be healing for couples.
Yeah, I know it. And you have done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of disclosures between the two of you. And I remember seeing you both at an APSATS board meeting whereby we were at a conference ahead of time and you were holding up in your room working on this thing day and night. So I know you've given it a lot of effort. Hey, Janice, I was going to ask you, you've seen some disclosures gone bad. And I know that was part of the impetus for helping both clients and clinicians and coaches figure out how to do them well. Can you share some of your stories of things you saw that you just cringed at when you heard that partners went through, again, another betrayal?
Yeah, that was actually probably part of the impetus for developing the set of ideas that I have and beginning to create materials. I work, you know, both as the partner advocate, sometimes the disclosures advocate, and sometimes do disclosures as the couple's guide. But early on, I was doing it predominantly as the partner's advocate. And in my part of the country, there really weren't many disclosures going on, despite the fact that it was a pretty huge need from most of the partners I was working with. And the few that were happening not only felt so off the mark to me and on the impact on the partner, I'm not so sure that the other, say, therapist or guide involved quite was aware of that damage had been compounded that didn't need to be. I have had partners who I was working with who, because the process was so kind of unfamiliar and they were so overwhelmed, didn't tell me a disclosure was about to happen. they figured it out after it happened that, oh, wow, I really should have. I needed help preparing for this. I've had partners referred to me ostensibly to prepare for a disclosure that turned out to be just a polygraph. The reason she thought there was a disclosure because she was asked to write to read like a particular book, and so that was somebody I didn't know in that she was arriving in my office for a disclosure until the day I met her, or that she thought she was arriving. That gap, not through like intentional, but just miscommunication between the therapist, set her up for such unnecessary pain. I've had partners who were told to like go have a couple of sessions and you'll be prepared. I've had somebody show up who scheduled their first appointment like right after the disclosure, not knowing the impact it was going to have on them. And so this gap, at least in for me, the early days, I'd say maybe 2010 to like 2013, 14-ish, the gap of knowledge, it was just horrendous. And then the gap maybe in the field of knowledge about how you tweak some of the process to really make it partner-sensitive, trauma-sensitive, how you actually make the process one that helps her heal and ultimately helps the relationship heal, that was missing. And so that's mm-hmm. kind of what my mission to maybe have an impact.
And, you know, both of you know that disclosures can go horribly wrong. Let's talk to our listening audience right now about what a good disclosure could look like. And, Dan, I'm going to ask you to start that, and then you turn it over to Janice to finish it up. What did the good disclosure look like? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I will say I think one of the benefits of working with Janice, so Janice is in Texas and I'm in California, and one of the benefits of doing this is the reality that every disclosure I've ever done looks differently. Every couple's different. So we really have to tailor what the needs of the couple is in particular with disclosure. And what has been helpful is Janice and I do things a little differently, but what we found through this process of writing these books was we were forced to find a common language for things. We were forced to, to not just have every single answer figured out, but have more of a protocol for how we can help clients, how we can help other professionals, other coaches or therapists help guide their clients towards disclosure. So to me, the first place starts with the facilitators of the disclosure. I mean, in a perfect world, you'd have two people, one that prepares the partner and one that prepares the addict or the disclosing party. And not just those two people, but that those two people are on the same page. So we get a lot of ego sometimes in this community, and I think to have some humility that we need to collaborate with each other. We need to make sure that the clients are know what they want and need. We help facilitate it and guide for sure, but to know what's the extent that we're dealing with. So I think it starts with having the.
Did we just lose Dan? I think we may have lost you both. So feel free.
No,
to
I'm here.
On. Oh, good. Okay, well, you continue because I think we just lost him.
Well,
you remember
okay,
he was saying it starts with the facilitators and that they have to be on the same page and that sometimes clinicians have egos. And so you really have to develop kind of a camaraderie that to work together.
Yeah, and I think that the way that we created the workbooks help with that process. We really wrote them mm-hmm. directly the people going through the disclosure, the partner and the recovering addict. So we had to like take on the standpoint of if you don't know what the process is like at all, you don't have terminology, you don't know what that there actually can be some choice points and what they are and how to determine them. So it's sort of in writing it for that, we realize it becomes much easier than using this material for the guides to be able to real quickly kind of say where they differ on their standpoints and to sort of in their procedures and process and to educate their clients. And in fact, we actually include a section on, you know, once you've determined your needs, how do you find a guide who kind of fits, you know, that their process really fits what your needs are. So we included that in the process. And Dan said that he and I do things slightly differently, although I think our sort of guiding philosophy is the same. But every time Dan would write a point from, like, the perspective of preparing the attic, if he introduced something and I'm reading it and editing and giving feedback, it's like, wait a second, I don't have that in the partner's version. She's not going to know what this is. I got to go write now something in her version so that the two of them are really kind of on path all the way through the process.
Can I ask you something? Because one of the things that I, you know, I do a lot of the APSATS training, and so I have to share with them what is absolutely APSATS, but then I also share what can work for me. And one of the things, and Dan is on the call too now, one of the things that I really defer, who this disclosure is, it helps the addict. It keeps him from keeping a secret. But for, it's really, in my mind, for the partner. It's so that she'll finally know the truth. And so, of course, we always say if she doesn't want a disclosure, that's her option. But what I was going to ask you is, one of the things that I always do if I'm working with the addict and somebody else is working with the partner, I allow them to lead. They get to run the thing because it is for their client, the partner. And, of course, we get together and talk about how to do that and are we going to be on the same page and do we have the same kind of belief system about what this document's going to look like. And that's why I just have to tell you guys, now we have a real document that's going to spell it out from A to Z. So my question is, do both of you see this as being for both of them, or do you – I don't want to say customize it for the partner. Of course, she gets all of her questions answered. But do you believe the document is more for her? And I'm going to ask each one of you.
Can I jump in first with that? First of all, I don't know, my call just dropped off, which actually I was thinking about that earlier when I was coming back on. Some of this process is about how do we navigate, how do we deal with things that are unexpected? And I think even just this as an example, how do we as guides for the couple, how do we help them? You know, for anyone on this call, a good facilitator is going to be able to support your needs, is also going to be able to collaborate and have a good respect and a good working relationship with the other facilitator involved, or other facilitators if there's multiple. You know, sometimes there's a couples therapist or couples support. I think this may sound overly general, but I think to go answer your question, I think the disclosure is for everybody. Certainly for the addict to unburden lies and secrets that have been held for maybe the whole relationship. So that's a huge part of the disclosure, is unburdening those secrets, building a new foundation based on truth and integrity and honesty in a relationship. But clearly it's the same for the same reason. You can't really, what's a relationship, you know, if we have a model of a pyramid in the books, and if our goal is intimacy, how do you have intimacy without vulnerability? You need vulnerability of being known and knowing the other. But how do you have vulnerability without some sense of trust and safety? And ultimately, you know, safety and trust are built on a foundation of honesty and truth. So I think you can't really have a full, deep relationship that's intimate if you don't have a foundation of honesty and truth. So to me, the disclosures for the relationship, it gives the best chance mm-hmm. for a couple to continue to heal and continue to grow. And certainly for the partner, because it's like none of us, I sometimes use an example of surgery, but if I had cancer, I mean, we want to know the extent of the problem before we just go in and start cutting things out. You know, if we don't know, has it metastasized? Is it local? Where is this thing? We want to know those details before and have a really good assessment before we actually do any kind of treatment. So some ways disclosures like that, where we need to know the extent of the problem before we can heal. You know, if the partner doesn't know, are my best friends safe? Is my family safe? Are, you know, these certain places that are really special, or these occasions that I thought were really special, are these tainted? Are these impacted by the extent of the behaviors? They're going to walk around with a lot of lack of safety and a lot of fears and insecurities and trauma as a result. So to me, it builds a new foundation of truth and honesty for the partner, for the addict, for the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Good. Very well said, and I agree 100%. I kind of, I know this is my bias, I like that partner to feel like she is getting exactly what she wants, and I want her to have that truth that you said is at the foundation of authenticity and intimacy, and I even know that you two are probably going to be working on some intimacy things as we get farther along on this journey. It's kind of spurred you to want to help people develop intimacy. That's what I find couples really want. Now, I'm gonna go back to Janice for a second. So, Janice, you know, some people think that they can do a disclosure on their lunch hour, or some therapists think that they can provide a disclosure on a lunch hour. So can you share the amount of time that goes into a disclosure and the process itself? How much time does it take?
Well, I think I'm going to try to combine that answer with the answer to the previous question, because I agree with Dan that it's for everybody, but I have maybe a slightly different, emphasis on how that relates to the partner and relates to the time, you know, for preparation. I see that the disclosure process is about healing. And for the partner, part of the healing is betrayal and betrayal trauma. And one of the things I have kind of over the course of my career is a really strong background, both in training and kind of work, in dealing with trauma healing, trauma recovery. And a piece that's almost always missing or very diminished in something that's traumatic is choice. And another piece that's always either missing or diminished is the time to sort of really gather your wits and figure out how to respond and respond from an empowered place. So for me, it's been really important that a lot of the choice points around what the needs are come from the partner. So there are a lot of exercises kind of in the workbook that really help her to determine what her needs are and how they can be met best, and then allows that information to be shared with the disclosing party and guide. So is it possible to do a really, really quick disclosure? Yes, it is. People do that. Is it possible to do it really well in a way that best meets healing needs? Not so much. On the other hand, if something that waits, if the partner waits so long, you know, years, to get the information, you know, by the time it happens, her pain, her trauma is actually exacerbated. So we developed a process that allows, through the exercises, allows those kind of needs, the choice points to be determined. Dan's developed a process that really helps the addict step by step to create the disclosure document, the timeline, and respond to the needs of the partner. I would say if I've got somebody that's working, Dan and I think talk this over, and we felt like to prepare the disclosure document that you're looking at least like 6 weeks, and that's often like with the guide doing some of the editing, some of the work happening outside of the session instead of in the session. You know, for the partner, it really depends on how stabilized she is to begin with before you begin the active prep. If there's somebody who's done like a lot of healing work already, has some really good self-regulation practices, well, then it's about just determining what the needs are and, you know, beginning the process of coordinating that with the other side. If a partner is like at a really different point, if she's still in a lot of shock from maybe what she discovered and discoveries that have been rolling out since, or if there's some ongoing abuse going on, well, you have somebody in a really different, you know, starting point. And so that person is going to need to actually some building up kinds of help in order to get through the disclosure in a better state of being. It's kind of like if you know a storm is coming, it's wise to prepare with supplies. So I think I stand in that place where sometimes there are absolute needs for something that happens very rapidly. And if that's the need, then that's what you work within. But my preference is for a little bit of a moderate where there's some, you know, the time for the coordination, the time for choice points, the time for the staging of the disclosure, right down to the setting that's in a way that makes her feel the safest, that gives her a sense of, okay, I can't choose what the information that's going to come to me, but I can choose how I receive it.
Absolutely. And so, obviously, as trained therapists with hundreds of hours of experience, you probably have a minimum of how much time to save for that disclosure document. Does that change based on its length, or do you say, oh yes, I allot 2 hours, no, I allot three, no, I allot five, oh, I allot a whole day? How do you handle that?
In terms of the disclosure, I'll just speak for the way I do it. If it takes the whole day, it takes the whole day. I try to do my disclosures on days where I have absolutely nothing else on the docket. And, you know, an average time frame sort of in the disclosures that I've guided, maybe hour and a half, 2 hours is not uncommon. But I've had disclosures that have gone as long as 9 hours because there were lots of complexities. Sometimes that's about the length of the document and the number of new kind of, disclosures coming out. Sometimes that's because it just generates a lot of in-the-moment trauma. And we give him the time that's needed to pause the process and work with whatever's coming up emotionally, spiritually, physically. And so I would say I wouldn't consider it unusual, not the norm, but not unusual to have a disclosure go, say, for 5 hours. And I've had a couple that have been around the 9-hour mark. And for me, it's about I really wouldn't want my surgery to be interrupted because the physician, you know, was out of time. I think it's really important that guides, you know, arrange their schedule so that it takes as long as it takes to do it well.
Got it. And Dan, what would your answer be?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. My answer starts with a mistake I made, or at least something that I won't forget. I remember one disclosure. I think I allotted myself 2 hours. I thought it wouldn't go longer than that. So I scheduled clients right after that. And I remember it was really clear it was going to take longer. So here I am taking a break from the disclosure, calling clients, letting them know we're going to have to push back schedule, like rescheduling people, pushing things back. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to do this again. So I generally give myself 4 hours, even if I think it's going to go in 45 minutes or something. I generally do that. I also, like Janice, I try to do disclosures on days where maybe I have some more margin in the morning or the afternoon. I might make it the last thing I do in a day so that I don't have to feel rushed, because the last thing I want to be doing is thinking about the clock and are we going to make it in time and somehow rushing the process. I mean, generally they don't need to go that long, but I never know. It doesn't take that long to read through the document. Usually it's about the different phases that we generally do with a disclosure. The first phase would be just kind of getting familiar in the room, what's going to happen, ground rules, orienting to what we're going to be doing. Then the disclosing party reads through the document that he or she's created. And with taking breaks, sometimes we need to take a break to process information, to reground each other, ourselves, and regroup. And then we take maybe a bigger break at the end of finishing, when he finishes the document. And then we come back if there's more questions, clarifying questions to be answered, if she wants to share anything in that moment. And that can take a little bit of time as well. So, yes, of course, the timing does depend on the length of the document, but there may be some things that we address that need to get addressed that I couldn't predict. So I generally give myself 4 hours for this. And I also wanted to emphasize too, I give a lot of choice to the partner in terms of what room are we doing this? Where does he or she feel safest to be doing the disclosure in the first place? Is it their disclosure guide's office? Do they not want it to be in that office? They want it somewhere else, to arranging the room, to who walks in and out of the room? Is it the addict that leaves? Sometimes it's the partner that says, no, I want to actually have the freedom to leave the room and walk around and escape if I need to. So I give a lot of choice to whatever the partner needs for her or his safety in doing a disclosure.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And so let me ask you this, because my experience has been that most partners really handle a disclosure fairly well during the process. You know, are they a bit in shock? Probably. Are they a little bit numb? Probably. Could they be experiencing some post-traumatic stress and disassociation? Yes, and it's our job as facilitators to help them work through that and be as present as possible. And at the same time, they usually get that information and it's not as bad as they thought, because their mind races and they think horrible, horrible things. And even if it is, it has been set up so that it is as safe as possible. They've got somebody that can help them process it. They got somebody, I'm sure I remembered reading that you're available to the partner or the addict the next day. I mean, if they need something processed, you're available therapeutically, correct?
Well, can I answer that question, Carol? This is Jana.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, first, a caveat. I would agree with you that the partners that you facilitate the disclosures with handle it really, really well, because I know that you prepare them really, really well and that you work to be that safe object for them. I'm contacted by partners all the time who've had different experiences, from maybe guides who do this very, very differently. And so that was maybe part of the impetus, too, for preparing the workbooks, of like a little bit of consumer education for the clients, but also hopefully some education for those doing the disclosures. My experience has been that, yeah, when you really attend to her needs, that it does go much better. And absolutely, you know, we try to like set up the opportunity for contact or processing or a session, you know, as soon as after disclosure as possible, or at a minimum, because, you know, sometimes that partner has a coping plan that really involves like, no, what I've got my recovery support group and they're meeting me at, you know, at the hotel I'm staying at, and we're taking the weekend, and they'll be my sisters, you know, so to speak, will be there with me. I think that whether you're talking about the partner or the addict or sometimes the couple, having your guides to be available as soon after the disclosure as possible is really important.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's so interesting you said that. I had a disclosure once where I was the partner's therapist, and literally she was having difficulty not with all of the sexual acting out, but one of the sexual acting outs occurred at her daughter's daycare. And the fact that he contaminated that for her was so horrific that now she would never be able to walk into that daycare again and feel good about picking up her daughter. She literally got up and fell to the floor. She was a mess. However, she did have a support network that was meeting her at her hotel, which was 3 minutes from my office, and they went to her favorite restaurant, and they took selfies and sent them to me. I happen to know most of them because this is such a small community, but just celebrating that she was resilient and has worked through some of this. And it was just so nice to see somebody get so much support after something that was so devastating, it literally knocked her off her feet. So
yeah.
I get that 100%. And support makes all the difference in the world. And that's what your book talks about. Let's talk about this book for 1 second. The name of it is Full Disclosure, How to Share the Truth After Sexual Betrayal. And it's actually a workbook, and it has three parts, correct?
Correct.
So that's the addict's version.
Exactly, the disclosing parties version, the addict's version.
The partner's title for workbook is Full Disclosure, Seeking Truth After Sexual Betrayal.
Seeking Truth After Sexual Betrayal, okay. And so the addict has a three-part series for his disclosure information, and the partner has Seeking the Truth. Full Disclosure, Seeking the Truth.
Yeah, the actively seeking of the truth. And there are three parts to the partner's workbook as well. I think for the first part for both workbooks is just the, you know, psychoeducation about what a disclosure is, and so they can really kind of understand it in order to make some of those decisions. The second part is the actual preparation for the disclosure, you know, the right of truth itself. And then the final part for the partner includes the partner impact statement, some grieving work, some resolution work before the very, very last sort of a couple of sections are, you know, returned to the coupleship.
Got it. And then, Dan, for the addict, what are the three parts about?
Fairly similar for the addict, and if you see the workbook, it may be daunting at first. It is fairly large, but I think that we really wanted to make this process as understandable as possible. But the first part is really, what is disclosure? What are some disclosure misconceptions? Is it right for me? What does it look like? Just understanding what the whole thing is about. So that's the first part. The second part would be preparing for the disclosure, and for the addict or the disclosing party, typically that means the disclosure document. That's the most important thing, because we want to be creating something that involves what the partner wants to know, leaving out things that maybe the partner doesn't want to know, specific questions that she or he has, and really getting this thing as complete, full and complete as possible. So that's the bulk of the work. And then the third part is now after disclosure, moving from, and I'll credit Janice with this one, I think it was, you know, the idea of moving from the disclosure that he is given that's based on his story to now understanding his partner's story. So the disclosure itself is a journey where he shares his past, his sexual history. But after the disclosure, it's now trying to understand, okay, now when these significant events were going on in the life of my partner and our relationship, now what was going on, and really helping understand and have empathy and help his partner as she's grieving. So I will, this is also, I think, ties in well with your book, Carol, in terms of it's an empathy journey. It's starting to build empathy for the partner and what she's going through post-disclosure.
Well, absolutely. So is there a restitution aspect of the disclosure for the addict that he can do to show empathy?
Yes, absolutely. We haven't put that in this workbook simply because, not because it's not important, but simply because it just became such a massive volume. So that's part of something that we're going to be creating for the next steps, because what we wanted to do was get through the immediate, more the short term after disclosure, which is really about safety building, rebuilding trust, rebuilding just that foundation of truth and honesty. Then it's moving, as you're building empathy, to rebuild the restitution as he deepens the acknowledgement and the understanding of the impact of what he or she's done on the partner. So yeah, absolutely. That's a part of it. That's something that we're working on, or we'll be continuing to develop, but yes, absolutely, in the future.
Okay. So I've got one more question for you, Dan, because I get this all the time. And it's a very valid question. I say that an addict has to be in good recovery, his own interpersonal recovery, with any of the addictions that he's got going on. I was going to ask you, do you believe there's a certain amount of time a clinician should wait, or a partner should wait, as he's working on that recovery?
That's a fantastic question. I love it. I don't have an easy answer, and maybe Janice will have something after what I share. But in general, yes, in a perfect world, the addict would have 90 days or so of sobriety, of consistent sobriety, that they would have that before we do the disclosure. That's in a perfect world, because we know there's neurological changes. The addicts often talk about this fogginess in their brain that starts to lift over time, especially after continued sobriety. So for sure. Yet, what we do know is, according to APSAT's research, which keeps being validated from what we've seen anecdotally and what we continue to see and hear from partners, is that wait time after discovery to disclosure is one of the most distressing and upsetting and painful and traumatic periods for partners. So in a perfect world, we would have as much sobriety as possible, but we also have to balance that with the needs of the partner, which is getting truth and information as quickly as we can. So we're always wrestling between those two areas. For example, I've seen sometimes addicts, if we say, okay, we say a hard and fast 90-day abstinence or sobriety mandate before we do a disclosure, I've seen sometimes addicts will get to 60 days, 75 days, 80 days, but they won't quite make it to 90. And I think in some way it's conscious or unconscious sabotaging, so that they can keep prolonging the disclosure because they're really scared of it. So I think we have to really be careful for setting hard and fast rules, to know, yes, theoretically I want to have good, solid sobriety and recovery, but I also want to balance that with not traumatizing the partner more by waiting and prolonging this. Last thing I'll say, I think of one situation where a partner had to wait 4 or 5 years for a disclosure, which I just don't think was necessary. So how that level of trauma she experienced for waiting that long was just so incredibly upsetting.
I would totally
agree with Dan, because ideally, if there can be 90 days of sobriety, of course, that's common sense. But sometimes there are situations going on where the partner can't settle down to do any of her work or feel any sense of stability whatsoever, because there's maybe two or three really pressing questions. And so sometimes that might involve a mini disclosure process or an emergency disclosure under certain types of situations, with a fuller one to come. But that situation that Dan has talked about, where you never make the 90 days, you know, you're 2 years waiting to hit the 90 days before the disclosure. I've actually had that happen quite a bit. I also work with addiction, sex addiction, betrayal, and a relationship pattern called intimacy anorexia, and that's a real common one there. And so, in some cases, it's about the fear, but there's also can be a control aspect of that. And in that case, the partner may choose, knowing that some of the information, the facts, may not be fully developed, or even the disclosure have access to the compartment. She may choose to want to do the disclosure sooner rather than later, because it better meets her needs, that she doesn't know if we're looking at 90 days or 10 years before he's ready. And she has to, like, in order to meet her own needs, she needs to do it on her terms.
Got it. Okay, so guys, we have to wrap up, and I'm going to give each one of you a minute to share any last information, and especially how they can find these workbooks. Dan?
I'll defer to Janice first. Oh, you want me to go first? Okay. I'll start then. First, there's a couple different places. You can go to our websites. We've created a website for the workbooks, so that's www.disclosurehope.com. And I think I each of our websites you can link to it as well. You can find them on Amazon as well as other local retailers, online retailers. So that's one way you can find it. But I would just say to anybody listening, my heart is with you, especially if you're considering disclosure. I think I can speak for Janice. We never set out to in our careers to write a book on disclosure. This wasn't the initial thing, but I've just seen how important this is for the healing journey. I've just had such a heart for helping couples heal through betrayal trauma. So if you're contemplating this, first of all, I'm sorry that you would have had to be in a place to even consider this, but my heart is out to you. And, you know, if there's any way we can support you in helping this be as healing as possible, we're here for you.
Okay. And then Janice, you have about 45 seconds.
Sorry, Janice.
The partner workbook is actually not out yet. It should be out very, very shortly. Again, you can disclosurehope.com, or it'll be on Amazon, or you can contact me directly, and I'll send you kind of a notice when it's available, and that's at drjaniscottle.com. And I would say that, you know, my basic training is as a relationship therapist. It's about, like, intimacy and helping relationships develop that. And it became so apparent to me that the disclosure in not happening is a vital piece of, like, preventing that. And the disclosures that happen and can happen well, yes, there's sort of some recovery time to that, but it for the first time really gives actual, genuine, solid hope for the relationship to heal and in many cases become much deeper than you ever imagined.
Very well said. And guys, again, I cannot thank you enough, because this is so important to establishing that safety. That's what we at APSAT stand for, is finding safety in an unsafe situation. And the disclosure is such a process. Thank you for doing all this work to create what I'm calling the Bible for disclosure. Thanks again.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Thanks.
All right. We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one. Bye. Okay, again, amazing people, Dan Drake out in California and Janice Cottle out in Texas, and they have written full disclosure, how to share the truth after sexual betrayal and actively seeking the truth. And you can go to the website they talked about. If you didn't have a pen, contact me directly at Carol, carolthecoach.com, and we will get you that information. And as I say at the end of every show, listen, everybody, whether you're an addict or a partner, there will only be one of you at all times. So fearlessly have the courage to be yourself and to do the next thing. And we'll see you next week for more Partner Betrayal Recovery Radio. Have a good one.
For more information, go to APSATS.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.